Good evening, everyone. Thank you so very much for joining us tonight for the fifth event of our series titled Black Wall Street, the Past, Present, and Future of Black Excellence. For those that may be tuning in for the first time, my name is Amanda Chesting, and I am a diversity officer at the University of Tulsa in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I will be co-moderating tonight's event alongside Dr. Dale Caldwell. As always, I have to take a moment to thank all of our sponsors, including the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame, the Black Inventors Hall of Fame, and the Black Tennis Hall of Fame, for supporting this event series to honor Tulsa's Black Wall Street and celebrate the wonderful achievements and successes of previous, current, and future Black leaders. But before I introduce our spotlight guests and enter into the question and answer portion of the program, I will actually turn it over to Dale, Glenn, and James to introduce themselves to new audience members and have them share a little bit about the organizations they represent and talk a little bit about the upcoming induction ceremony that will take place in Tulsa on the commemorative week of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. So, Dale, I will pass it to you to introduce yourself.
Well, thank you, Amanda. I'm Dale Caldwell. I have the honor of being the founder of the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame and the Black Inventors Hall of Fame, working with Glenn Best, the executive director, and James Howard, to really commemorate and record the incredible stories of people who've been overlooked because of their race in history. So with that, and now they'll make the announcement about May 30th, I guess I'll turn over to Glenn.
Thank you, Dale. Good evening, everyone. And first, I'd like to thank Amanda and the University of Tulsa for co-sponsoring this event with us. This has been a tremendous, a rewarding experience. Our panel series that we kicked off in the fall, leading up to the program that we plan to have in May. But before I touch on that, I'd like to give a little acknowledgement to the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame and what it's all about. So, you know, there's been a brilliance of ingenuity and innovation and creativity amongst Blacks the entire history of Blacks in the United States. And we, one of the things that the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame seeks to do is to, one, acknowledge the success of those Black entrepreneurs who are all around us, those who have preceded us, to, one, bring their accomplishments to relevance, those histories that have not always been written in our history books, have not been acknowledged, and to capture those moments, but to also celebrate them and to elevate and inspire a new generation of Black entrepreneurs. We're very fortunate to have a wide range of partners that have taken this journey with us to help us in promoting and elevating this event. We are excited about our induction ceremony, which we plan to have in Tulsa in May. We will be inducting six inaugural members into the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame. The Black Inventors Hall of Fame will also be inducting the six members. You will start to hear more about our inductees over the next several weeks. But we are excited to have these pioneers, and that's what these halls of fame represent: pioneers of our industry, of all industry sectors, whether it's hospitality, whether it's healthcare, medicine, science, business, finance, just a broad range of different sectors and all the successes that have transpired that often are overlooked and sometimes are unseen. So with that, I again like to thank Amanda and her team and Dale for having the vision to launch our Halls of Fame. And I'd like to pass it over to my colleague, James Howard.
Thank you, Brother Glenn Best. Appreciate that. I'd like to begin by thanking Amanda and the University of Tulsa for partnering with us in this important spotlight series. I welcome Brother Warren Thompson, and I'm certainly looking forward to hearing what he has to share with the audience tonight. The Black Inventors Hall of Fame subscribes to the mantra of looking to the past to encourage the future. And over the past few months, we have been preparing the looking to the future of the Tulsa event that will take place on May 30th. And at that particular event, like the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame, Black Inventors Hall of Fame will be inducting 6 inaugural members, 3 from the past and 3 of the future. And it's moments like that that will actually take us into the future as we continue to try to put forth the message of just how broad and large our community of people have been, and to uproot untold stories, as Brother Glenn Best had mentioned. And we do that through sessions like this, the Spotlight Series. We do that through events. But we're going to continue beyond May 30th and continue a message of putting forth the important genius and abilities of a collective group of people that have helped to move this nation forward for nearly 400 years. And with that, I'll turn the mic back over to Dr. Caldwell.
Yes. And, Amanda, I think you'll do an introduction.
Yes. Well, yes. Yeah. So thank you both, Dale, Glenn, and James. But speaking of Black entrepreneurship, I have the honor of introducing tonight's guest, Warren Thompson. Warren Thompson just truly embodies the spirit of Black Wall Street and leads through entrepreneurship and community outreach. And so with that being said, Warren Thompson is the president and chairman of Thompson Hospitality Corporation, the largest minority-owned food service and facilities management company in the U.S., with 6,000 associates and a revenue of more than $760 million. Thompson Hospitality operates in 48 states and 6 foreign countries, providing a wide range of services. Thompson Hospitality was founded in 1992 when Thompson completed a leveraged buyout of 31 restaurants from his previous employer. He proceeded to convert the stores to show-lease restaurants and several other proprietary restaurant concepts. Warren also expanded the company's interest into the contract food service arena, and in 1997 created Thompson Hospitality Services, by forging a contract in partnership with Compass Group, the world's largest food service company. Through this alliance, Thompson Hospitality currently serves more than 65 Fortune 100 companies, large universities, and hospitals. Additionally, Thompson Hospitality has developed a specialty niche in providing food service to many of the nation's historically Black colleges and universities, becoming the largest player in that segment. Thompson Hospitality's growth in revenue now places the company 10th in Food Management Magazine's ranking of the 50 largest contract companies. The Washington Business Journal has ranked Thompson Hospitality as 2017's number one minority-owned company. Previously a recipient of Black Enterprise Magazine's coveted Company of the Year Award, Thompson Hospitality is ranked 8th among industrial service companies on Black Enterprise's BE100s list. On an individual level, Warren Thompson has been recognized throughout his career for his success in business and his contributions to the community. He has received many awards and honors, including the Humanitarian Award for the Congressional Black Caucus. He was recognized by Smart CEO Magazine as its CEO of the Year and Entrepreneur of the Year by the National Black MBA Association. Thompson has had the honor of serving on the board of directors for several major corporations and universities, including the Darden School of Business Foundation Board, University of Virginia's Board of Visitors, Hilb, Rogel, and Hobbs, Pepsi-Cola's African American Advisory Board, and the Federal Realty Investment Trust. Service on other board of directors appointments include Compass Group, Duke Realty, Performance Food Group, and Hamden Sydney College. Thompson received his Bachelor of Arts degree in Managerial Economics from Hamden Sydney College and holds an MBA from the University of Virginia's Darden Graduate School of Business Administration. So welcome, Warren, and thank you so very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much, Amanda. And after that introduction, I think we can all go home. No, thank you so much.
We have some questions for you, Warren. So okay. Our group, the group that's putting this on, is called the Black Excellence Alliance. And so for those out there, you can find us at blackexcellence.org, blackexcellence.org. And so you are a model of Black excellence. And I feel I know you because I've been a lifetime member of the Black MBA Association. I remember seeing you when you were just starting out, and you were really a model of what an MBA could do, and you've just come so much further. So that being said, you know, tell us a little bit, what took you towards this career and what pushed you to be an entrepreneur?
Great. Well, Dell and the group, I grew up in the rural part of Virginia, the second son of educators. In that part of the country, African-Americans at that time in segregated schools were not exposed to a lot of industry or a lot of different career paths. Most people in my town either worked at the shipyard or the meatpacking plant, or you were a minister or a school teacher. So growing up, I knew that I wanted to get into business. And at an early age, my father was a math teacher. My mother was a home economics teacher. After school, I would go to either my father's class and learn math, high school math as a first grader, or I would learn how to cook in my mother's home economics class. So I became pretty good at food and numbers. And so it ultimately led to being in the restaurant business. When I was 12 years old, I was sitting in a Shoney's one night with my parents in Portsmouth, Virginia. And I said to them, I'd like to own one of these one day. And my father said, you can do whatever you want if you're willing to work hard. So from that point on, my focus was on becoming the owner of a restaurant. I watched people in that Shoney's come in, sit down, pay their money, get a plate of food to eat. And I said, wow, that's a great way to make a living. Beats working at the meatpacking plant. So I think it was at the age of 12 that I decided this was what I wanted to do. And from that point on, everything was focused on trying to learn how to run a restaurant, basically.
Wow, what a great story.
Yeah, I love that. And so you kind of mentioned a little bit of the kind of challenges kind of starting out, or just kind of the normalcy of working in a meatpacking plant or becoming a teacher, but can you explain a little bit of some of the sacrifices or additional challenges that you have experienced? And then kind of just how did you overcome those obstacles to achieve your just great level of success, today?
You know, I think as an African-American growing up in the South, you have challenges. You know, I was in segregated schools until the fifth grade. So you start off in a situation where you're not on equal footing, at least from a resource perspective. Now, I would flip that around and say from a support perspective, culture and community, I probably had the most support during those years than I've ever had. I never had a teacher from the first through the fifth grade tell me I was not smart or I could not do something. It wasn't until integration took place that I had to confront those types of challenges. So as integration took place and I got older and started to move up, as you move up, you start to face racism at every twist and turn. So as an example, going to Hampton Sydney College, my college during that time had a rule that only two Blacks could graduate in any given year. So my class had six of us to enter, two of us graduated. We didn't know this was the rule. We didn't know it was the policy. But if you look back for 15 years, only two Blacks were allowed to graduate in any given class. So there was a tremendous amount of racism. And So as an example, if I reported racism to the dean would say, well, if you don't like it, just go somewhere else. But the same token, what that did, it made you rough. It made you tough. It made you able to confront racism head on. And we as a collective group in the school, the African-American students, planned how we would take over the school. So we would meet every week and strategize how we would take over the school, run the student government, run the student court, take over athletics, run the newspaper. And it caused us to spend time figuring out how to organize and how to get ahead. Going off, I argued my way directly into graduate school and said I'd worked enough as a kid. As a kid, I raised hogs. I sold produce. I had a grass-cutting business. So I had a lot of businesses, and I made the argument that no one else applying to the Darden School had raised hogs or had sold produce out of a school bus. So they allowed me to come directly. But once again, as the youngest person in my class, in grad school, and an African-American, I had racism thrown at us. At Darden, 50% of your grade was based on class participation, but the professor would not call on Black students at the same rate they would call on white students. So you face the racism there. But then when I graduated from grad school and my first job, the second day at work, I was called in by an executive and said, do not expect your career to be the same as the two people ahead of you in the same program. And I said, what do you mean? He says, because you're Black. And I want you to know that your career is not going to be the same as Chuck and Steve's, who were two white guys, both attended the same graduate school, both were in the same fast track program that I was in. But the flip side of all of that is I went to that company with a mission to learn how to run a restaurant company. And I said to myself at the age of 30, 7 years in, I would leave and start my own company. I actually stayed until I was 32. But the fact that my career was going to come to an end very shortly, I was not going to go any higher than what I had achieved at the age of 32. I was the highest ranking Black in the company, but I knew the glass ceiling was cement for me. And so that really forced me to go out and do what I needed to do and wanted to do. And that was start Thompson Hospitality. So I say all that to say racism is tough. It's a challenge. But the flip side is it often sharpens you up. It causes you to be better than the competition. And it prepares you just about for any challenge you're going to have to face. If you can beat racism head on day in and day out, solving a financial problem isn't that big of a deal. You know, it toughens you up. You can figure out how to get creative, how to do a deal with very little cap. When I started this company, I only had $100,000 and it was a $15 million deal and I retained 56% of the company at the time. So retain 56% with $100,000 on a $15 million deal. That was creative, but it was the kind of stuff that we learned, that I learned how to do back when I was in college facing tough situations or back in grad school facing racism. How do you figure out how to maneuver, how to pivot, how to work around, and how to get ahead?
What a great answer. So, you know, I'm sure there are a number of entrepreneurs in the audience and a number of people who will see this videotape. So you've grown your business rapidly. What are some of the elements of growth of an entrepreneurial business? You know, what would you say to people to look for and do to grow their business?
Right. You know, I think an entrepreneur, first and foremost, is a risk taker, right? But the question is, how much risk are you going to take, or how do you make it a calculated risk proposition? You know, I'm an entrepreneur, but I'm not an inventor. And when I say that, I take risk, but I don't have to create the model. So Thompson Hospitality today is a mirror image of the Marriott Corporation, which is my former employer. So when I went to Marriott, I said, I want to learn how to run a restaurant, but more importantly, I want to figure out how to develop a family-owned company. Mm-hmm. So Marriott was a family-owned business, started in 1929. It started as a restaurant company. Then it moved into contract food service, then into hotels. Thompson Hospitality started as a restaurant company in 1992. In 1993, we moved into contract food service, and now we're into hotels as well. So we have followed that blueprint. Marriott was a family company. I brought my brother and sister in within the first 60 days that we started the business, got in business. So we made it a family-owned company. If you look at Marriott, Marriott started with, had one hotel brand. Okay, now they have 30 or so different brands. They've divided the market among their own brands so they can serve you whether you're looking for extended stay, the Ritz-Carlton experience, or what have you. But we're doing the same thing with the restaurants. We have now 15 different restaurant brands. So I can put brands next door to each other and service that customer as they may have different needs. One day it's quick serve. Next day it's full service. The next day it's delivery only. So following the blueprint of a successful company is a way for an entrepreneur to minimize or reduce the amount of risk, or make it a more calculated risk as opposed to an untenable situation.
Great advice. That's really good advice.
Yeah. And you kind of, you know, continue on with that point of just really not reinventing the wheel, but making that already existing wheel work for you. What additional kind of guidance do you give young folks specifically who are wanting to grow their own businesses and just kind of just advance in that entrepreneurship field?
Right. Great, great question, Amanda. You know, I always tell young people, starting out, you're going to make mistakes. And that's great. It's fine to make mistakes. If you're young and you make a mistake, it's more of a learning experience than it is a catastrophe. If you make a mistake at 60 years old and you blow your money, it's too late. So I always say learn, but learn on someone else's nickel. You know, so try to determine what it is you want to do as early as possible. And then go and get some experience in that particular field on someone else's nickel. So once I realized that I wanted to be in the restaurant business, I didn't go into banking after college. I didn't go into technology. I decided to go into the restaurant business. And I started as an assistant manager in a fast food restaurant within Marriott, the Roy Rogers division. Assistant manager, unit manager, district manager, regional manager, real estate manager, special projects manager, vice president of operations, so forth and so on. But each time I was learning and picking up different skills while being paid by someone else. And I made some mistakes. I'll never forget, I picked a real estate site, I did a real estate deal. That restaurant lasted 3 months before the Marriott had to shut it down. Okay, good thing it was on their nickel because I couldn't afford too many of those on mine. But I learned from that experience, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, going to work for someone else and learning on their nickel.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
So, Warren, Thompson Hospitality, what would you say is its greatest asset? Kind of two questions. Its greatest asset and what is the cultural footprint of the organization as far as employees? And
sure. In fact, in answering that question, our greatest resource is number one, our people, and number two, our culture. Mm. So the question you ask is a good one and relevant because the two work hand in hand. We have some of the best people in our industry. We have the most diverse group of people in our industry. And it's not by design. And unfortunately or fortunately, I've never had to have a diversity and inclusion position in the company, because our culture is that. And it's not something we've had to do by design. It comes natural. If you pick the best people for the job, out of a country that is as diverse as ours. Diversity is natural. It's only when you stop picking the best person based on qualification do you end up with a skewed demographic. And so I simply try to choose the best people I can find to join our company. And then when I look around the table, they're all different, different colors, different religions. We have one of the most diverse group of executives. They don't all get along. And probably some of them on the call today. When I say they don't get along, they don't hang out after work because they're all very different. But at work, they have one focus and one mission, and that's to make our company successful. The second part of the culture is we're very entrepreneurial. So people join our company who are entrepreneurs. And maybe they're not to the point of wanting to start their own company, but they are to the point of having a big chunk of their compensation tied to the success of the company. So the key players are all equity participants in the company. So they're owners. So my CFO, as an example, when he's watching the numbers, he's not only watching my numbers, he's watching his numbers. And it's more important that he's watching his numbers because self-preservation is the first call to any person.
And you know, this kind of diversity and inclusion aspect is just perfect for this next question. So really just kind of from your own perspective, you know, we are living in a really unique time, to say the least, right now. So from your own perspective, you know, how does, you know, our current social climate impact minority-owned businesses in terms of the COVID-19 pandemic, in addition to the ongoing social justice concerns that we're seeing right now?
Right. You know, I've always said if I had a choice when I was born or created to pick any person or any race, I would pick being an African-American in America. Now, we've been through some very difficult times, but I was born in 1959, very difficult times in the 60s. And I was sheltered from that by my parents and my church and so forth. Today, fast forward today, as an African-American male, I have every opportunity to succeed. You know, we can all sit back and say times, you know, it's tough, we've got racism, we've got this. But yes, you also have more opportunity to stand out, to earn the recognition that you deserve. And I believe that as an African-American business owner today, and given the conscience of the country and the world, it couldn't be a better time for business and African-American business to do well and take advantage of opportunities that are owed to us. Okay. We will never get the 40 acres and a mule, the reparations. That will not happen in America. At least it will not happen from taxing one group and giving money to the African American. But what will happen and what should happen and is happening is that more and more companies are recognizing and entities are recognizing that it's a good thing to do business with African American companies. You know, when I started my company and we had 31 restaurants, 30 of them were leases. I had landlords who would not want to meet with me because I was Black, and I'd have to send my white employee to deal with that landlord. Okay, that's not that long ago. Let's say 28 years ago. Today, it's different. I can put a sign up in my window of a restaurant saying Black owned, and sales will go up. 20 years ago, if I had done that, sales would go down. So there is a unique opportunity today. Now, there are some that if you put that sign up, and we do have some signs up in some of our restaurants saying African-American owned or Black owned. And I have a lot of people who will patronize and say, we're patronizing because we want to support a Black owned business. And that's coming from both Black and white customers. It's a different day. That would not have happened 20 years ago. So I think African-American businesses are in a unique opportunity today to take advantage of what is owed to us. And that is just an equal chance to do business with a good product and a good price. And if we can provide that, then we have every opportunity to thrive today as any other corporation.
Warren, I'm still thinking about your quote. If you hire the best people, diversity takes care of itself. Is that your quote? Did you do that, or do you take that from someone else?
That's what I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I really believe that. I mean, I've put it in practice, and I've sat on boards of companies, and I won't mention it. I've sat in other organizations where there is not diversity. And they've said, we can't find diverse candidates. Right. No, you're not looking for them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because if you truly open up a process and you take the best person, 15% roughly thereabout will be African American. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just the way that, you know, it's when you start to say, well, I want the best person that fits, quote unquote, in the culture. And when you put that stipulation on it, now you start to narrow down the population and you start to get away from what is the best candidate. And you get into the arena of what is the best candidate that I'm comfortable hanging out with.
Right.
Fit is often a code word for comfortable.
Right.
You know, like I said, my executive team, none of them hang out together because they're all so different. Mm-hmm. But I've been on other boards or on boards of companies where they all hang out together after work because they drink the same beer. Mm-hmm. They go to the same bar. They like the same music. That's not diversity. Right.
So follow up to that is, I mean, you've been so successful. What is the future of Thompson Hospitality hold? Where are you going? What can you look for over the next few years?
In answering that question, I'll go back to the question Amanda had, too, about the pandemic and so forth, because I don't think I addressed that. When the pandemic occurred, or prior to the pandemic occurring, Thompson Hospitality, we were preparing for a downturn in the economy. Through the Obama administration, we had 8 years of consistent growth. That carried through for the couple, 2 to 3 years of the next administration because the economy was on a roll. But I felt and we felt that it was only a matter of time before the next recession would hit. So we were preparing for that. We were getting into a more cash position. We were being more conservative on investments. We were doing things to position ourselves. We were reducing the average size of a restaurant. We were really looking at revenue per square foot and looking at those kinds of things. We were trying to diversify our portfolio of contracts, getting more into healthcare and areas that would be less susceptible to a downturn in the economy. We did not envision a pandemic as occurred a year ago in last March. We would have never guessed, and no one could have expected that. The moment that occurred, we got together as a team and we went into emergency mode and we said, look, we all took pay cuts. We started to really look at our cash position. We started to cut costs. We started to do things drastically. For about 30 days, we were in that mode. Right after that, we started to say, how are we going to take advantage of the opportunities that are going to come? A lot of restaurants are going to shut down. They're undercapitalized. They're too large for what they're trying to sell. All of those things. So we started to then become very aggressive in acquisitions. And we've done now 3 acquisitions since the pandemic. We're going to probably do another 3 or 4 before the end of this year. We've now put more restaurants in the pipeline for development. We're opening a new restaurant every month somewhere on the East Coast. We will get to the point of opening a restaurant every 2 weeks going into next year. And starting in probably 60 days, the restaurants we're developing will be in the pipeline then for 2022. That's kind of the lead time on getting a restaurant open. So we're divided now into 4 divisions: our joint venture division, large corporate accounts that we run jointly with Compass, our solo division, the HBCUs, our facility division, which janitorial, landscaping, plant operations on college campuses, corporate centers. And then our 4th group, which is our retail group, is our largest or fastest growing division today. By size, it's probably our 3rd largest division, but soon to be probably our largest division at some point down the road, because a lot more emphasis on growing in that area. Through acquisitions and organic growth. We will finish 2022 with approximately 50 restaurants, up from where we are at 23 today. And we'll be at 100 restaurants by the end of 2022. Wow. We're also growing in the hotel space. We opened a new hotel behind our corporate office. It's now a training center, development center for all of our people. We're also using it as a testing facility for our restaurants. But we're now also developing a niche of going in and operating food and beverage in existing hotels. So in many cases, the hotel operator will sub out the food and beverage piece because they don't want to be in it. It's a losing proposition for them. We may go in and in some cases operate it on a management fee basis, or if we believe it has a true P&L opportunity, profit and loss opportunity, we'll take it over, pay some rent back to the landlord or back to the hotel, and then take over the food and beverage. So that's the niche. So long story short, I'm hoping, my plan is by the end of 2022 that we'll be at $1 billion a year in revenue and then go forward from there.
Fantastic. And you're privately owned?
We are, yes.
Fantastic.
No, that is awesome.
Today we are.
Never has to say today.
Those facts are hot things out there these days. Right.
But that is so incredibly, you know, just impressive. And definitely I would look forward to seeing what Thompson Hospitality, you know, comes up, I guess, in 2022. But, you know, you have just a wide range of community outreach, and your company just also equally has a wide range of outreach. So can you talk a little bit about just social impact and what it means to you to represent so many employees and represent an entire company that positively has an effect on people's lives, whether they know that you are the one that's doing it or not?
Right. You know, social responsibility is the right thing. And one can do the right thing and make money at the same time. Okay, they don't have to be opposites. And I think one of the things we've tried to create is a company that people can feel proud to be a part of. So when we decided, as an example, to get into the HBCU business, my original business plan said we would get into it in year 5. We got into it the first year because the Shoney's brand started to tank. So we were going to have to get out of the Shoney's business. We didn't own the brand. And we moved up getting into contract food service. And when we got into that business, I realized that it was such an underserved market. The larger companies were taking the highest profit margins out of the HBCU business and investing the least amount of money in terms of developing the assets there. So I said, this is a true business opportunity, and it's a chance to do the right thing at the same time. So we got into it, and we started then becoming very competitive, putting in the proper amount of investment to support the account. When I say investment, it's not unusual for a food service operator for a 10-year contract on a college campus to build out a new cafeteria, to build out the retail operations. That was not happening on HBCU campuses. So when we got in, we started doing that. The profit margin in that business is about 7%. It's not the highest profit margin business. Some of our competitors were pulling out 25% margins. So getting in and being willing to work for 7 to 8% margin and being willing to reinvest in the universities put us at a competitive advantage. So then our competition had to start following suit. So I look at it and say there are 100 HBCUs out there. We roughly run 20 of them today. But the other 80 have benefited by having us in the game because the competition has had to step up and do what they should have been doing anyway. So we feel very proud of it. We also say to our clients, you cannot find a can of corn or a can of spinach in any of our accounts. We only serve fresh vegetables because I don't want to serve a can of sodium and corn. And that's basically what it is. When you're serving vegetables out of a can, you're giving that student a lot of sodium, which is increasing the high blood pressure factor, the diabetes, and all of those things that we should not be doing. So we are also challenging our competition to do the same thing, to offer the same quality of food they will offer at a majority institution. They should be doing that at HBCUs. They should not be offering to the HBCU the same meal program they put in prisons. And that's what some of them were doing. So we uncovered that kind of thing and took the lid off of it and exposed it. And I think we've changed the industry as it relates. If you go to any HBCU campus now, you'll see a relatively new dining hall. You'll see Chick-fil-A. You'll see all the things that you will find at major universities. That didn't happen prior to Thompson getting into the game. So I feel good about that. And it's not something we go around touting, but we feel very good about it as a company. Over the course of the last 25 years, we've contributed over $50 million back to HBCUs through financial support, scholarships, and so forth. We don't tout that a lot, but likewise, I feel very good about that. I have mentors, students that I've met at schools. There's one young man. One day I was visiting one of our accounts. They picked me up at the airport. I got in the front seat with our manager. I looked in the back. There was this young kid sitting back there. I said, who is that? Somebody picked up on the way. He just wanted to meet you, Mr. Thompson. He just wanted to meet you. He is still now somebody I mentor 15 years later. Wow. He's a sharp young man, graduated from Savannah State. And we've been, we've had this now mentor-mentee relationship for the last, as I said, almost 15 years. And it's those kinds of relationships that have developed over the years that I feel so good about. We have a lot of young people that have come into our company as interns who are now in management positions. The next program that I want to work on is having young people work with us while they're in college, graduate, work with us for 3 to 5 years, and then become a franchisee of one of our brands. And we'll provide the financial support for them to get into business and start their own company. So this is going to be geared at that young person who wants to be an entrepreneur, who may not have the friends and family money to get them started. I'm going to encourage them to work with us for 3 years, 3 to 5 years, truly learn the business, and then we'll provide the financial backing to let you start your own company. So
that's incredible. Right. And is that just for HBCU, students at HBCU?
No.
or is that all universities?
It would be all universities, but we have most of our accounts at HBCU. So of the 22 accounts that we have today as Thompson only accounts, there are 20 of them are HBCUs. Now, we do some majority institutions. Well, we have Hampton-Sydney College, my alma mater, and the Darden School. I have to do those. But we have also NYU as an example, or Texas A&M that we operate as joint ventures with Compass Group. And yes, we have relationships with students on those campuses as well.
What a great,
fantastic opportunity.
What a great announcement. So, you know, one of the reasons we have our May 30th event, where we are celebrating the past, really the success of the Greenwood District and the future with the Halls of Fame, is because during segregation in the Greenwood Black Wall Street, Black people supported Black businesses. And so as I'm hearing you, one of the things, and then I'll get to the other question, how do we find your restaurants? Is there a directory? We'd be happy to work with you to have a directory where people can go there and say, I'm in Tulsa. You know, is there a Thompson Hospitality restaurant? Is there a place that somebody can go to see if there's a restaurant in their neighborhood?
Yeah, there are various African-American or Black directories now for businesses that have come about. A lot of them have started in the last couple of years or so, and we are listed on all of those. Even Uber Eats today now has a listing of Black-owned businesses, Black-owned restaurants, and that's something new. So, you know, since George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, companies have become far more bold in that support than ever before. So if you go to Uber Eats and Google Black-owned restaurants, it'll pop up. DoorDash, same thing. So yes, and there are other directories out there. But our website would have all of that information as well.
Well, we definitely want to make sure that folks support and know where you are. So, you know, one of the most segregated, least diverse parts of the world in America are corporate boards.
Right.
And, you know, one of the goals is to really obviously diversify and get more people. And you've served on a number of major corporate boards. One, you know, talk a little bit about how somebody gets on the board, and also, you know, what you've learned from those boards and how you've influenced those boards.
Right. First part of that, and I'm going to take just a second here to give a plug to your session a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, maybe, Ralph Sampson was on, and I called in and said, I'd like to recommend Ralph to the Board of Visitors at the University of Virginia. Well, Ralph and I subsequently met after that a couple of times and talked and rekindled our friendship and relationship. And we're going to do a restaurant together now in Charlottesville, Virginia, that's going to have Ralph's name on it. And Ralph and I are going to be partners on that. So I'm very excited. But I've also had a conversation with a person I think will be the next governor of Virginia. And I've said, you really need to look and consider Ralph Sampson for the Board of Visitors. Because listening to Ralph that night reminded me that he's a very intelligent, shrewd business person who happens to be an athlete. And we need to understand that he has everything that one would want and need to have to be a good board member. And if he earned millions of dollars for the University of Virginia back in the day, it's time that they recognize him now for his intelligence as a business person and put him onto that board. So I would venture to say 2 years from now, Ralph will be on that board. Hold me to that. But back to the other point, how does one get on boards? That's a good start. Once you're on a major university board or foundation board, it's usually from that then you can make connections and translate that or parlay that over to corporate boards. So my first corporate board, I'll never forget, two alums, both had been alums of Hampden-Sydney College and University of Virginia. So they came as a pair, and they were both, you know, I had the same alma maters as both of them. And they came in and said, Warren, we'd like to consider you for our corporate board. And they said, we heard you will hold us on the diversity issue, but you won't embarrass us. I said, absolutely not, not me. So I got onto the board. Then when I looked at the company, I called them. I said, look, guys, I have to admit, I lied. And if you don't do something about diversity, I'm going to embarrass the hell out of you. So you know, once you get on, they can't get you off, because what are they going to do? Terminate you and then say, we fired him because he believed in diversity? Okay. So that was a lot of fun. And we ended up with a CFO in that company who happened to be African-American shortly after that. A year or so later, the company was sold to another public company, and the CFO that they brought in led through that whole transaction and made a ton of money for the shareholders. So it was a case in point. He would never have been CFO of that company had it not been for a push on the issue of diversity. And so I think, you know, getting onto a board is easier today than it was even 10 years ago. There's such a demand. I will probably get a call every couple months now about another board, and I'm on too many boards already, so I can't take any more. But now I've joined on an advisory board for an agency that is responsible, is one of the lead agencies in the country in terms of placing people on boards. So this fellow who has the agency was smart enough to say, okay, let me get an advisory board of some African-Americans who can help direct me to great candidates. It's just going to help his business. When XYZ Corporation calls him up and says, I need an African-American board member, he's going to then call us up, and we're going to help provide candidates for those positions. So it's a great time to be in a position seeking board seats today as an African-American.
Well, there are a few people on this call who would love to be candidates.
Right. So, absolutely.
Yeah, but this is great. Yep.
Good.
Well, you know, you talked a little bit about the importance of diversifying boards, but just from your own experience and from perspective, what additional changes do you want to see happen in the business sector and in universities just as a whole?
Right. So boards need to be diversified. We often talk about entrepreneurs and so forth, but we also need corporate executives, because entrepreneurs will benefit greatly when the executives are diverse. I have a better shot of getting a contract with a major company if the chief procurement officer happens to be Black. Okay. Even if I never meet that person, I know that person sitting in the cubicle is making the decision on whether I get the contract or not, is conscious of who his boss's boss's boss is. And so having diversity in key corporate positions makes the life of an entrepreneur trying to do business with those corporations a lot better. So we need both. We need African-American business owners, and we need a diverse group of corporate executives as well. So I think anything we can do, when you look at the number of CEOs of Fortune 100 companies today, it's a lot less today than it was even 7-8 years ago. I think it's probably only 4 or 5 today, okay, down from maybe 10 to 12. So we've gone in the wrong direction. We've got to turn that around. And a lot of those have left due to retirements and so forth. But, you know, we miss those. We miss the CEO of Boeing being African-American, you know, American Express. Those positions, you know, if I look at the contracts where I do food service, there's a high correlation between diverse CEOs diverse senior executives and companies where I happen to be providing food service. Okay.
Let me ask this question, because I'm just listening to you, and really just such brilliance here. Has there ever been a Fortune 500 company that was founded by an African American? Do you know?
Beatrice. I would say TLC Beatrice was on.
Well, that was purchased. That was really purchased. That was one of them.
Right. You're right.
And I'm thinking, you know, this brother could be, you know, really take a company that you founded from the ground to a Fortune 500. So we're rooting for you, man. We're
Bob Johnson too. BET was not on the Fortune list, but you know, Bob is a good friend. But if you look at Bob Johnson, he is truly a pioneer. We're all hearing about SPACs today. Well, right. Bob did a SPAC 10 years ago when he took his hotels public. So. He's always been at the forefront. He was one of the first guys to take a company public, take it private, take it public again. Okay, so a lot of times things that we're seeing happening today, we've got people like Bob Johnson, John Johnson, pioneers in our industry, Reginald Lewis, those guys did these kinds of deals and transactions.
Yeah.
When I started my company, I was trying to raise $1.9 million. I went to Reginald Lewis's office in New York, sat there all day long like Bud Fox from Wall Street, tried to get into the game, left my business plan. He called me later and said, I'll give you the $1.9 million for 85% of the company. I said, I'm sorry, but I don't want to come work for you. I'm getting out of one company. And the guy who did the analysis on the deal left him, came and helped me put the deal together. And that's how we were able to get the transaction done. Wow. Turns out, he gave $1 million to Virginia State. And the only other group that we've given $1 million to Virginia State in honor of my parents, they both got degrees at Virginia State. So it's full circle how two donors of that school connected at that one point in history. But he was always somebody I admired from afar and read everything I could that he wrote.
I mean, what a great businessman, and his wife, who's a friend of blackexcellence.org, is amazing too. Just an amazing group of folks. And so, you know, we're almost near the time, but I guess one of the questions is, yeah, but you've done so much. You've been recognized with community service and all this stuff. I mean, what should companies be doing as far as community service to really try to make a difference, you know, in the community?
You know, I believe that obviously we're talking about environmental issues at all times. We're talking about, how do we make sure that as companies we step up and do what is socially responsible? I'm one, and I'll tell you what we're focused on. We're focused on youth. You know, I'm very committed to the next generation. I look at most of my time and effort and energy and resources go toward trying to make a difference in a young person's life. Everybody has a passion for something, but that's mine, and that's where we are as a company. And I'm fortunate because of the kind of business I'm in, I can come in contact. I have missed that over the last year with the pandemic. But I can't wait till I can get back into the classroom and go back in. I would have been a teacher, but for the fact teachers don't make any money and don't pay what they should get paid. So if they were paid better, I might have been a school teacher. But I used to substitute teach when I would go home from college and so forth. But now I enjoy that more than anything. I mean, when I get a chance to go into a classroom on an HBCU campus and teach a class on entrepreneurship or what have you, it's great. I teach a class at Darden every year. We do a case on my company. And I enjoy going in and raising the whole issue of racism and how you know, and it's Darden is still vastly majority white, but to confront that issue head to head with those students and ask, you know, and say, well, you know, I got a great deal when I did Shoney's because they had a discrimination lawsuit. And confronting that issue that they gave me relief on royalty to repay for some of the sins that they had done to others.
Right.
And you know, getting into those types of conversations, they're fun, but I think it's also something that we owe the next generation to try to make things better.
Well, thank you, Warren, so very much for offering just all of your insights. I mean, you are doing some amazing things, especially with your scholarship and just community outreach and mentoring programs. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this evening.
Absolutely.
So we are actually